Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The first case we're going to call this morning is State v. Michael L. Washington. But before we do that, I would like to introduce the court to you. To my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abramson. I am Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm sitting in the Chief Justice's spot today because she unfortunately had a family bereavement. She needed to be out of town. She asked me to sit as her designee. So, good morning. To my left is Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Michael Gableman. To his left, Justice Dan Kelly. With that, I would also like to acknowledge that I believe we have Burlington Central Catholic High School here today. Are you here? Could you and your teachers stand up and we could just say hi to you? Good morning. It's nice to have you here. All right, and Dodgeville High School, are you here? Go ahead and stand up, your teacher as well. All right, welcome. It's nice to have you here. The students are here with a program entitled Court with Class. It's a really neat opportunity for them to study up on a case, come here, hear the argument, and then have an opportunity to meet with a justice, not talk about the case, but generally talk about the court and how things work here, ask a few questions, and get familiar with how we conduct business. That justice is Ann Walsh Bradley. And so if time allots and you wish to do so, I think she'll be available to meet with you over the noon hour. Okay, with that, we really are now calling State versus Michael Washington. I believe Andrew Hinkle has 25 minutes, Sarah Burgundy 30 minutes, followed up with 5 minutes for Andrew Hinkle. All right, let's proceed. Oh, I should also add, Justice Rogensack is participating, even though she isn't physically present today. She will watch and make sure she hears the oral arguments, and then we'll discuss it later or, you know, decide the issues later as a court. Okay? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Ziegler. I am Andy Hinkle from the Appellate Office of the State Public Defender. I represent Michael Washington. And may it please the court, Mr. Washington was sentenced in 2012 to a five-year initial confinement sentence. So he's actually serving the extended supervision portion of his sentence now.
Counsel, make sure you speak up.
Thank you, Justice Bradley.
So I just said that earlier to Justice Kelly, too, so I'm an equal opportunity requester.
So what this case really provides the court is an opportunity to sort out what it is the circuit court is to do with a defendant who, for whatever reason, either does not wish to be present for his trial or is not present for his trial. Now, as the case has progressed through the court system, the issues have become clarified somewhat. I think both the state and Mr. Washington are in agreement that one of those mechanisms that's embodied in 971.04 sub 3 was not met here. That's a statutory provision that says if a trial has commenced and the defendant voluntarily makes themselves absent, then the trial can continue. The state refers to that as forfeiture. The Court of Appeals also referred to that as a forfeiture statute. I have to disagree.
Counsel, can you tell me what is it the circuit court judge did here that was wrong?
And
what should the circuit court judge have done? Here we are. We are not in the position perhaps contemplated by the legislature when it passed the statute of the non-appearing defendant and protecting the rights of all of us from being tried in absentia. In other words, okay, the person's been served, no defendant, no problem, let's have the trial. That's not this case. Here we have a defendant who absented himself. The phrase, I think, was, I'm gone. And that seemed to be more of a prediction and a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it happened to have been said prior to the jury having been sworn. Now, the circuit court judge characterized it, and it struck me as odd, and an odd characterization, and I can imagine all sorts of reasons why it would. It's not an everyday occurrence for circuit court judges, for people in the courtroom just to say, I'm gone, and then to leave, albeit escorted, because he was in custody by bailiffs, no doubt. So here we have the instance where the trial court judge described it as semi-removed and semi-voluntarily absent. I'm not sure that my reading of the record bears that out. I think I'm not quite sure how anything that the judge said was an exclusion from the court. Now, you could say, well, gee, he was semi-removed because after he said, I'm gone, I'm sure he went into the custody of the bailiffs and who took him back up to the jail cell. But what should the circuit court judge have done here?
First of all, I'll say I agree with you, Justice Gableman, that the 971-043 procedure essentially was intended to deal with a defendant who's actually absent. That is, you can't have any sort of colloquy with them because they're not there and you don't know where they are.
And we don't know why they're not.
And we don't know why they're not there. So your more, I guess, central question of what should the court have done here.
What did he do wrong and what should he have done?
Well, so as you say, the court characterized the departure as semi-removed, semi-left on his own or something along those lines.
But it's our job to figure out what actually happened. One member of the bench doesn't exactly buy that he was semi-removed, because I don't even know what that means.
Well, I guess I'd point to a little later on in the record where the circuit court is discussing, sort of musing to itself about what it's going to do, and says some things about an aggressive demeanor on the part of Mr. Washington. So I don't know. I wasn't there any more than you were, and I don't know.
So all we have is the record.
But anyway, we have is the record.
To the central question.
In that instant, perhaps he did depart or needed to be removed from the courtroom, and that was a reasonable action for the bailiffs or the court or whoever directed it, or Mr. Washington. Well, I suppose it wasn't reasonable for him to take.
Well, let me just
but in
ask,
any case,
is
he's
it
gone.
Your position he was removed from the courtroom?
All we have is the record. I can't make
You keep falling back to that, and what you're falling back to is the judge's characterization of the record. You and I are capable of reading the record. From the reading of the record, not somebody's characterization of it. You've read it, obviously. You're very familiar with it. Do you think Mr. Washington was removed from that courtroom?
I suspect he didn't walk necessarily on his own power.
Okay, sure, but that happens when in time? It happens after he says, I'm gone, and stands up, that's what the record shows, and begins to leave. So, of course, someone who's in custody, by definition, is not free to leave. So your last statement is more of a tautology than it is an explanation of your opinion.
Well, I suppose I simply don't see a basis in the record for me to give an opinion as to what happened any more than other than what the judge said. But I don't think that it matters too much. One way or another, he was gone. Now, at that point, the question becomes, what does the circuit court do? And in my view, and I think the cases from this court and other courts about what waiver is, there are a lot of options that were available to the circuit court other than what it did. First of all, Mr. Washington, within a few minutes, certainly was in a jail cell. We know that. It certainly, every day in every, not every court, but every day around the state, defendants are brought to court in handcuffs, in leg irons, with stun belts, things that prevent them from being a threat, a real threat to the people in the courtroom. That was one option. It could have had Mr. Washington return to the court, not necessarily for the trial, but simply for the sake of establishing, you know, you understand that we're going to go ahead with the trial. You understand that this is disadvantageous. Here's the ways that it's disadvantageous. If you want to continue to behave in this way, that's what's going to happen. Failing that, if it was true that Mr. Washington was really such a grave security risk to those in the courtroom, again, he's in a jail cell, and we see in some of the cases, Dovanovic being one of them, visits to the jail by the judge, with or without the lawyers, with or without the court reporter, to say, hey, listen up, Mr. Washington. Again, this trial is going to happen. You're going to lose your right to confrontation. You're going to lose any ability to, you know, explain things to your lawyer about the facts of the situation. You're going to lose the ability of the jury to see you. You're going to lose your ability to see the jury. You're going to lose your lawyer's ability to make any sort of judgments about any juror's reaction to you during voir dire. Now, these are all sort of somewhat amorphous things. You know, they're not not as clear-cut as, say...
Well, no, they're not amorphous. They're a way of explaining to him the problems and disadvantages he gets from not being present. And that then gives him full information. And then, if he decides he's not going to be there, you can argue, or the state can argue, it's a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of the right of presence. The problem that the state has in this case of showing knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver is you don't have a record that he actually knows the advantages of being present. That's how I see it.
I agree with that point, Justice Abrahamson. I would add, you know, to be fair, the record indicates, obviously, that there was communication. It wasn't direct communication with Mr. Washington. It was through intermediaries. It was through bailiff at one point. It was through his own trial lawyer, I believe, at least one point.
Well, there were five separate communications between the bailiff and the lawyer. There are at least five separate communications. And is it an issue that his leaving the courtroom, that he did so in an unknowing, that his departure was done in an unknowing, unintelligent, involuntary fashion? I mean, which of those three are you arguing? And if you're arguing it now, why didn't you argue it in your brief?
Well, I guess I don't think it's true that I didn't argue it in my brief. The state's response to the opening brief, in which I said, hey, the 97104 sub 3 process wasn't met here, was to say, well, even outside that process, this is simply a waiver.
Okay,
and in
so
my reply,
which one do you say wasn't met?
I don't believe it was knowing. I mean, I think you could make a pretty strong argument it wasn't intelligent. It was.
You and I, and we all know that intelligent decisions are not in the colloquial sense of the word intelligent.
Absolutely.
What a defendant in Mr. Washington's view might meet the legal standard of an intelligent in the knowing, intelligent, voluntary analysis might not be what any reasonable person may agree is, gee, that was really intelligent.
Yeah, that was a smart thing to do. No, I agree with you,
fair
Justice
enough.
Gableman. However, no, I would, I guess in a more legal sense, I would say an intelligent waiver of the right to be present would involve making sure that the defendant understands the advantages of being present, sort of the things that I was just discussing, confrontation, you know, the ability to be seen by the jury, the ability to aid your lawyer, the ability to testify.
How about voluntary?
Well, that's, again, where we get into the question of exactly how he was dragged out of there. But I'd return, I think, to my position, which is that, you know, yeah, that was one instance. It was probably fairly chaotic. That wasn't the whole ball of wax. It's not as if we assess this quote-unquote waiver in this sort of perhaps scuffle and say, well, now he's waived it, game over. There were many opportunities.
Do we assess this under the same standard that we used in State versus Soto?
Yeah, I think that's the appropriate way to look at it. And
in Soto, did the court have a colloquy about the waiver of presence being knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
Well, this court, I believe, used the phrase. I don't recall if intelligent was in the list. It was certainly knowing and voluntary, and I don't know that the circuit court in Soto used those words, but this court, in blessing the circuit court's actions there, did say it engaged in a sufficient colloquy to ensure a knowing and voluntary waiver. That is, said, first of all, Soto was different because the defendant was still participating in the trial. He was simply present by video link. But the court established, first of all, that, you know, the video link was working and that everyone could communicate adequately for the needs of the procedure, but also that Mr. Soto understood that he had the right to do otherwise and that it was fine with him, that right. That arrangement was okay.
So Mr. Washington understood he had the right to be present for his trial, correct?
I would concede that.
All right. So is it possible, we've been discussing this so far in terms of waiver, but I want to look at something a little bit differently. Is it possible to expressly waive the statutory right to be present at trial?
That is a question I guess I've wrestled with in preparation for this argument. I think that, again, the 970-104 procedure is a little bit closer to waiver than the state is letting on. Because, first of all, it includes the word voluntary. First of all, the defendant has to be voluntarily absent. Second of all, as Crosby explained, and the United States Supreme Court explained in Crosby, the point of requiring presence at the beginning of a trial is to sort of serve as a proxy for knowingness and understanding that, hey, this trial is happening with or without me. So I don't think it's fair to exactly call that a forfeiture statute.
Yeah,
I think
so
it's a little forfeiture plus or maybe waiver minus.
Yeah, so let's, I think perhaps part of the hang-up here is we're trying to figure out what it was that he meant by his conduct. And maybe that's not the paradigm we should be looking at. Is it possible to, with words, let's say he goes beyond verbal and he writes out, I hereby expressly waive my statutory right to be present at trial. Is that sufficient? Can he do that?
I mean, I guess I wouldn't be willing to concede that that's necessarily lawful. I think the legislature establishes the rules for these sorts of things. Certainly they've established a set of rules here. And this is unlike some instances in which the legislature says, you know, you're going to do X, and they decide, the defendant agrees not to do X, because the legislature has specifically provided a mechanism by which the defendant can waive, and that wasn't what was done here.
Right. So
now, even allowing.
Yeah. So this 970-104 that we're discussing is a relinquishment of the right to be present by his conduct. Right. He absents himself. So that's not talking anything about an express waiver. And we know that you can waive your constitutional right to be present at trial, right? And you can do that expressly, yes? That's correct, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So if you can expressly waive your constitutional right to be present at trial, and statutory rights are lesser creatures than constitutional rights, why would you not be able to expressly waive your right, your statutory right, to be present at trial?
Well, I mean, in one sense, I suppose it's a question of the separation of powers. The courts, of course, safeguard and interpret the constitutional rights and determine what the rules are going to be as far as when those can be given up and how. The legislature has expressly provided this mechanism by which this right can be, again, forfeited, waived, whatever you want to call it.
By conduct, right? 970-104 is, this is how you waive your right to be present at trial, by your conduct. Is there anything in the statutes that prohibits the defendant from waiving his right to be present at trial expressly?
There's certainly no direct language saying that can't happen,
okay.
No.
And because the legislature provides a way to waive your right by conduct, does that necessarily mean the legislature meant that you cannot waive your right to be present at trial expressly?
I don't...
Your argument seems to answer that question is you can only do it by conduct, not express waiver, which doesn't sound right, does it?
Right. No, I understand where both of you are coming from. I guess my position would...
So what's the answer? Because we've got to do something with this.
Well, that's not this case.
Right. That's my ultimate
okay,
answer.
Well, you know...
Barry Heck is in the mail.
A lifeline. Mr. Hinkle,
that was very wise.
Even if you can so let me that he can express wave, he didn't hear.
Well, if I might see if I can get an answer on this, because I'm not sure that's not this case. Right. I'm not sure that express waiver is not this case. He didn't just absence himself from court, did he? He said something. He said many somethings. And all of those somethings were, I'm not coming to my trial, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was very brief, but...
Okay. So why could we not look at that as an express waiver? And if we can, then we have to answer the question of whether you can only waive your presence by conduct, which would be odd, or if you could also waive your presence by express words.
I don't think it's so odd. And the reason is, first of all, again, the waiver by conduct, if that's what we're going to call it, is a mechanism to deal with what's otherwise an impossible situation. That is, again, the defendant is simply gone and incommunicado. You can't reach him or her. And so there's a mechanism by which we say, hey, the trial may continue because we've invested too much at this point to not continue. I suppose the countervailing interest or the reason why I think there's, you know, a reasonable position that express waiver is not permissible, even though that's not my ultimate fallback position, is that there are more interests at stake than simply those of the defendant here.
Well, but isn't your real answer back to the first question that Justice Gableman gave you is, are you arguing that that he didn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waive?
Absolutely. That's certainly
my
argument.
So then you're answering a question, why can't he expressly waive? And didn't he expressly waive in this case? And didn't you say he doesn't expressly waive unless it's knowing and intelligent and voluntary here is a problem?
Yeah, no, I would say if the defendant may expressly waive the right to presence, then that is not what happened here, according to the usual ways that the courts define waiver.
But you're still equivocating, aren't you? If the defendant may expressly waive, there is a certain tension that emanates from the position that a defendant can waive by conduct but not expressly waive. And
again, I think the answer to that...
That's hard to quite consider it as tenable. So that's my tension.
Sure. My answer to that would be the waiver by conduct is, again, a legislative response to what's otherwise there's simply no way to conduct the trial.
I'd like you to talk about harmless error, because it seems to me that that's an important issue in the case, because the state's position... at least part of the state's position, is not only did he waive his right to be present by failing to appear, not forfeit, but waive. I'm reading from page 2 of the state's brief. But finally, even if the court violated the statute, any error was harmless under the circumstance. So why don't you lose on harmless error?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, there certainly have been cases in which a defendant's absence has been declared harmless. Those are all radically factually different from the case that we have here. We have, you know, these sort of de minimis absences. We have absences from in-camera voir dire. We have absences from, in fact, in-camera voir dire of jurors who were dismissed and therefore could not have had any effect on the verdict. And we have a defendant's absence from the judge's response to a jury question. That is, you know, the lawyers sit in the courtroom and they decide what the appropriate response is. Those are not situations in which the defendant's, you know, presence is in any way necessary. Here he was absent from the entire trial, and I guess to answer a question with a question. In what circumstance, in what trial could we not say, well, the absence was harmless? You know, I mean, ultimately, we're always going to be here because the jury returned a guilty verdict. And what is the state going to be able to point to say, well, here are all the things that would not have changed had the defendant been present, or contrarywise, that the defendant would point to say, well, if I had been here, X. It's similar to the situation with the right to a public trial. You know, we have the right to a public trial, but if we had a trial in which members of the public were kept out, how would the defendant suffer?
Mr. Hinkle, one thing, and you might not have time to answer it all the way, but when you come back for rebuttal, and there are two reasons I'd like you to address it. Number one is you haven't so far, and it's, I think, an important part of the context of this case. And I have a strong suspicion that your opposing counsel is going to spend a lot of time on it. And that is the finding, and it wasn't made in a formal finding, but it was made in remarks that the circuit court judge made to your client in regard to your client's manipulation of the court system by having discharged two of the court-appointed attorneys beforehand. And then on the morning of the trial itself, February 12, I think, wanting to discharge the third one, and then in response, the circuit court judge saying, no, I think you're trying to manipulate the system. You're going to go forward with your trial ahead of time. You're going to go forward with your trial today. And whether that plays a part in... and whether it should play a part in the circuit court judge's obligation when we instruct through our opinion that comes out as a product of this case, whether that will play a role or should play a role in what the circuit court judge's obligation is to future people in Mr. Washington's case.
Sure. I'll do what I can with the time that I have now. First of all, Mr. Washington is in jail. He's been in jail for 13 months since his arrest. It's a little bit unclear to me what he would gain, what, you know, ultimate end he might achieve by failing to participate in his trial or by filing his attorney. I think it's fairly clear from the record that he's genuinely dissatisfied with his defense attorney, rightly or wrongly, whether he's in the right or not. And as far as whether manipulation plays into the determination of what the court ought to do, you know, perhaps it comes to a point where the court says, listen, here are your options. You can do A or you can do B. I think in some ways you can get a sense from the record. I think it's fairly obvious from the record that the court is by this time quite frustrated with Mr. Washington. He's been behaving in a frustrating way. And, you know, this is a situation which circuit courts have to deal with sometimes. And the question is, what do we do with that? And I don't think that the answer is, you know, let's just wash our hands of Mr. Washington and do this trial. I think it's, you know, even though Mr. Washington, you know, is the source of this problem, it's ultimately up to the courts to ensure that even difficult defendants get both justice and the appearance of justice. I don't think it does the system any good when we say, you know, get out of here, we're just going to have this trial. So ultimately, no, I don't think that it may impact the ways that a court is able to address a client, but I don't think that it touches on the court's ultimate responsibility to make sure that we're doing the very best to give, you know, justice and the appearance of justice.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Your Honors, the one person in complete control of whether Mr. Washington was present at his trial was Mr. Washington. And Mr. Washington does not dispute that he waived by his conduct his constitutional right to be present at trial. The case is about the statutory right. Now, opposing counsel suggested that the state agrees that subsection 3 was violated in this case, and that is not the state's position. The state's position is that subsection 3 deals with the concept of forfeiture, not waiver, and does not even apply in this situation. As the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals held, nothing in 97104 precluded Mr. Washington from waiving by his conduct his statutory right to be present, and this Court should affirm. Now, Mr. Washington's position hinges on a misinterpretation of the statute providing for the right of presence in criminal proceedings. In his view, 97104 sub 3 creates an absolute, unwaivable right for defendant to be present when the trial begins. That view is inconsistent with a plain reading of the statute, the policy behind it, and rather, subsection 3 merely creates a limited exception to the general rule that a defendant cannot forfeit by his absence alone his right to be present in trial. In other words, a defendant cannot derail an already started trial by simply disappearing.
Would you pull that microphone a little closer to you, please? Thank you.
Sure thing. Now, the plain language of the statute supports that interpretation. Subsection 1 of the statute provides for the different proceedings in a criminal trial. The defendant shall be present. It includes a trial. It includes voir dire. And as this Court has held in Soto and Dixon and other cases, a defendant can waive either expressly or by his conduct his statutory right to be present. A defendant, however, cannot forfeit that right by simply not appearing, and where subsection 3 comes in is it creates an exception to that rule. And it says, if a defendant voluntarily, after the beginning of trial, the defendant voluntarily absents himself without leave of the court, the trial may continue outside of his presence. And that's a policy matter of basically preventing defendants from derailing a trial that's already started.
That has been interpreted as after the jury has been sworn.
Right. The Court of Appeals has interpreted the start as after the jury is sworn.
All right. In the federal system, I think the case law has defined that as the day of the trial, regardless of whether the jury has been sworn.
Correct. And under Rule 43, there's different language where trial sort of encompasses the
whether what?
Under Rule 43, the language in Rule 43 discussing the portions of trial where, or the portions of the proceedings where defendant must be present, the discussion of trial includes voir dire. So under the federal system, it's the courts have generally understood the first day of trial to be the beginning of trial.
Well, and what I took from that was an inference that, again, as Mr. Hinkle, I think, quite reasonably acknowledged, was the idea behind these statutes is to protect citizens from unwarranted trials in absentia. And it seems that the federal system, the time for that is triggered if the person shows up on the day of their trial and then for whatever reason gets a case of the jitters or, you know, or has something better to do or who knows what, decides to leave. Well, the trial can go forward. Here in Wisconsin so far, it's been interpreted as when the jury has been sworn, but what I'd like to get at is there's been some discussion about the knowing, intelligent, and voluntary fashion of Mr. Washington's conduct here, and I, not so much about the voluntariness, Mr. Hinkle, again, quite reasonably, I think, said, well, that's a matter that the record will, we can all look at the record and we'll have to interpret that for ourselves. What do you say to the knowing and intelligent, and if you want to speak to the voluntariness, which you probably do, please, I would like to hear your version of that.
Sure. So on the, as the Circuit Court found, there was a lead up to this outburst on the first day of trial. Mr. Washington discharged his first two attorneys. The attorney that handled his trial was his third attorney. On the morning of trial, he tried for a third time to, or talked about not wanting to have that attorney represent him. And this was also after a pattern of making speedy trial demands, withdrawing them, giving his attorney additional information that she needed to research on the eve of an initially planned trial, and a number of acts that just struck the court as manipulation and avoiding the trial from occurring. Now, on the morning of trial, the counsel began by saying, I'm having trouble communicating with my client. He's refusing to talk to me. I tried to talk to him about his defense, and he is changing the subject every time I try to bring him back. He's refusing my help, essentially. The court engaged in a colloquy with the defendant at that point, asking him for his side of the story, and he basically said, she's not representing me. The court says several times, well, we're going to trial today regardless, and he says, no, we're not, and he says, and there's a, you know, again, the record just demonstrates what was said. It's not clear what's happening exactly, but he basically keeps coming back to the court, and the last line the court tells him before he is semi-removed, semi-leaves, is, if you continue this, we are going to remove you, and we're going to have the trial without you. And at that point, he gets up and goes. And I think the semi-removed, you know, my best guess at semi-removed, semi-left on his own was that he wasn't, you know, dragged out with his heel, you know, digging in his heels. He left with, you know, under the custody of the court staff. So he has, you know, at that point, he has talked to the court has told him that if you continue to act in this way, if you can't behave, you're going to be removed from the courtroom, and he is removed. The court then makes a finding of waiver of his constitutional right, and Mr. Washington is not disputing that he waived his constitutional right by his conduct. And so the court, from that point, just then makes the best record it can of the number of times and does as much as it can to encourage Mr. Washington to return and understand, help him understand that he knows that he has a right to return.
What's your response to the suggested idea of either bringing, you know, the court ordering the bailiffs to produce Mr. Washington in whatever fashion necessary, or going with the court reporter and counsel up to the jail cell and going through a colloquy, a traditional knowing, intelligent, and voluntary colloquy? Do you understand that by absenting yourself, blah, blah, blah? Has anyone made any threats or promises? Do you understand?
Correct. That's probably always preferable, and it's probably a better practice. I don't think there's ever been a case requiring courts to do that. And in fact, in the Seventh Circuit in Benabe, in talking about how courts are to deal with this situation, have made the point that you're not required. So on the point of, you know, shall we bring the defendant back? Let's bring the defendant back into the courtroom and either force him to be here for when the jury is sworn or get a waiver from him.
I'm not sure anybody likes the image of that.
Right.
So let's go to the jail
cell. Moving to the jail cell. You know, that would have been a reasonable step for the court to take, but the fact that the court didn't take that step and took other reasonable steps to ensure that Mr. Washington knew his rights doesn't mean that it was a violation of the statute. Now, you know, what happened here was immediately made its ruling on the constitutional right to waiver. Immediately after that, Washington's counsel went, told the court that it explained. She explained the court's ruling to him. She explained that he expressed that he understood that and that he was choosing not to return to trial at that point. The court then at that point began taking steps to minimize any prejudice to Mr. Washington by being not present. In choosing the jury, it informed the jury pool that Mr. Washington has a right to be present. He chose to waive that right. That's not something that you can hold against him. That can't prejudice you. When asked, a few jurors said that that would bother them, and they did not serve on the jury. The remaining jurors were asked if that would affect them. They said no, or at least no one said that it would. Again, there were steps at each point. There were steps right before the trial started. There was steps talking to him during a recess after the state began its presented its first two witnesses. At that point, counsel also talked to him about the right to testify, and he waived that. The trial continued at the close. I believe it was right before the jury issued the verdict. Mr. Washington was issued another invitation. During all of this, too, the court alerted the court staff and made sure Mr. Washington was informed that if he chose at any point to return, that he was to alert court staff and to come back.
Counsel, your brief discussed the case of U.S. versus, Benaby. How are we going to pronounce
it? I've been calling it Benabe.
Benabe it is.
But Benaby could be correct, too.
All right. Let's call it Benabe. Are you suggesting that we should adopt the Seventh Circuit's standard about when trial commences?
I am not, and not because that's necessary. It's not there's not an argument for it, but I believe in this case you can decide on narrower grounds and simply hold that subsection 3 doesn't apply. You can waive by conduct, and Mr. Washington did here.
Waive it by what?
Mr. Washington waived his right to be present by conduct.
Okay, I have a question about that. It seems to me that your position is subsection 3 is not exclusive way to waive the right to be present.
Could you repeat that? I'm not sure.
Subsection 3 is not the exclusive way to waive the right to be present. You can waive by appearing when the trial begins and then leaving, and this subsection says, in effect, that conduct constitutes a waiver.
No, my position on subsection 3 is that conduct that would normally merely be a forfeiture, such as absence without more, could function as a waiver.
That's what I just said to you, but that's okay.
Okay, but just to be clear, I'm not saying that a defendant during trial can expressly or waive by conduct
that's
at
right.
any point.
It's not exclusive way to waive the right to be present.
Yes.
That's what you say in your brief. Number two. Therefore, your answer to some of the questions posed to defense counsel is you can have express waiver, right?
Yes.
And indeed, I think it's your position here in your brief that there was express waiver here as a result of his conduct of not coming to court and saying he doesn't want to be there.
He waived by conduct, and then beyond that, he knew he was waiving beyond that. Yes.
Right. And to find waiver by conduct or express verbal waiver, does he have to knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily understand what he's waiving? That is, what his presence can mean to him?
I think he needs to understand that he has a right to be present and that he can waive that right. Beyond that, it's up to counsel. Beyond that, though, it's up to counsel to describe, to talk about the advantages and disadvantages.
It's up to counsel, not to court.
Well, how does... Oh, I'm sorry. Please, when you're done, respond to Justice Abrams.
That's why I'm asking you these questions. You say he's waived it by his conduct of not appearing after being given numerous opportunity, and I agree the trial court here practically told him every hour on the hour he had a right to come, urging him to come, telling the jury to not hold this against him, etc.
Right.
So my question to you still is, this is waiver, not forfeiture. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. What does he have to know in order to waive? What does to be a waiver, does his conduct of not coming or anything he said here, does it have to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
It has to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, and what that entails under a circumstance where a defendant is refusing to behave himself in the courtroom essentially means that you have a right to be present, but you need to be able to participate in the trial or not, and if you can't do that, we're going to hold the trial without you. Certainly, again, best practice is for counsel to talk about, try to talk him into going. Talk about what are the advantages and disadvantages of going to trial, but there's no requirement for a court to hold an on the record colloquy of all of the advantages, disadvantages,
okay,
et cetera.
My next question is, you made reference to the Seventh Circuit and the practice, but you didn't tell me, are you talking about a case in which the Seventh Circuit says the better practice is the court hold a colloquy? Is it somewhere in their rules of practice?
No, that's just, that's not from the Seventh Circuit case.
Okay. Well, where does it come from? I'm not finished
Excuse
yet.
Me?
All right.
Where
ahead.
Does that best practice come from?
That's just a matter of, when I'm standing before this court and you're asking me where on the record is there a knowing and intelligent
right.
waiver, I wouldn't be here if there was, or none of us would be here if there was a, that long list. So
right.
this is what, I think that's
not quite there.
Excuse me?
The knowing, intelligent, voluntary is not quite in the record.
An express discussion, the express colloquy setting that out and preventing an appeal is not there.
Right.
You're correct. It doesn't mean that his waiver was not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Well, how do you find it?
You find it based on the courts warning him that he's not going to be, they're going to hold the trial without him on the morning of his outburst. You find it when counsel went and talked to him, explained the ruling to him.
Well, how counsel does it work in the federal system? And I invite Mr. Hinkle's, Mr. Hinkle, if you have any knowledge about this, I'd like to hear your response. Under Rule 43 in the federal system, where the requirement is so long as the person shows up on the day of trial, and then they absent themselves, the trial may go forward. How does knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver fit in at all under that structure? It doesn't seem that it can.
It's not. It's imputed basically by the fact the defendant was there at the start of the trial. We impute knowledge. We impute the KIV knowledge or, standard to that, when he disappears. It's a waiver. That functions as a waiver.
And that's what the federal, and that's the federal court system. That is their scheme for addressing the knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver under those circumstances.
Sure, and that's the, that's what subsection 3 of 97104 does as well. And that's how subsection 3 of the Wisconsin statute functions as well. It says if you're there at the start of trial, we're going to impute the necessary knowledge.
Right, and the only reason it seems to me we're having this discussion about the KIV factors is because of the timing.
Correct.
The timing by which Mr. Washington said, I'm gone. So if he had waited an hour or however long it would have taken to select the jury and impanel them and swear them in, and then he had gotten up and said, I'm gone, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Sure. Exactly.
All right.
Can you tell me why you think that there still wouldn't be a need for a KIV, knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver, even after the jury had been sworn? And if there isn't a need for a formal waiver, isn't it yet the better practice?
So your question is, does there need to be a KIV waiver after the jury is sworn? So after trial begins,
and he says the same facts here, but just altering it.
The timing.
Mm-hmm.
If the same scenario, if the defendant is the conduct is preventing him from being in the courtroom or any situation?
Yeah. The only change in the facts is that the jury has been sworn.
if the defendant can be in the courtroom, and, you know, I think it you know, obviously the court's in a position of having to just do what it can under the circumstances. If the defendant's in the courtroom and the trial's already started, and he expresses a desire to not be there, the court can have an express, you know, get his express waiver on the record. If the trial's already started, defendant's in the courtroom and begins acting in a manner that's preventing the trial, he can get, you know, he can be removed. I don't think there's anything requiring the court to drag him back into the courtroom in front of the jury and have him, you know, go through this discussion. So, you know, it goes to, again, the, you know, when it's waiver by conduct, there is some discretion upon the, you know, for the trial court, especially based on findings that this is, you know, dragging him back to the courtroom is going to cause danger to Mr. Washington and to my staff, and I'm risking prejudicing Mr. Washington in front of the jury by dragging him back in, because they're just getting a view of this defendant that's either manacled or is, you know, fighting, or that we're dragging back in, and is, you know, we're going to, you know, and in that scenario, we could be back up here arguing, well, Mr. Washington didn't get a fair trial because the court insisted that he come back in to, you know, do the waiver and that sort of thing. So,
is there anything about the Court of Appeals opinion that is incorrect?
I don't believe so, no. I believe generally it followed the state's arguments to the Court of Appeals. So,
can you flesh out your harmless error argument?
Sure. In the brief, we talk a lot about the error in terms of the trial. If there is any trial in which the error could be found to be harmless, it's this one. And I set that all out in the brief. But an additional point that we should consider is that when you're looking at harmless error, you're actually looking at what the error is that the court committed. So if the error is that the court held the trial without the defendant absent, that's basically the point of the, you know, what I discuss in the brief, that essentially it's a, you know, it's a short trial. Counsel's there constantly. Counsel was able to raise the only defense, which was essentially a voluntary intoxication defense. And we have facts here basically where there's no question that Mr. Washington was the burglar. But if the error here is that the court didn't bring Mr. Washington back to the courtroom to waive, we focus on the error, what that, the effect of that error, and whether that error is harmless. And again, the Seventh Circuit case in Benabe is helpful on this point. In that case, the court said, you know, when a defendant's acting up in the way it did, it might be preferable to go and discuss with him the actual rights, but that the court didn't do that here isn't a violation. We don't require courts to give a defendant who's demonstrated a pattern of conduct one more chance to demonstrate that he's going to behave in the same manner that he's behaved before.
Well, then how's it error?
So here's
the error before you
again. So if the error is that the court didn't bring him back to the courtroom or didn't do enough follow-up, the error again is harmless because there's nothing in the record to suggest that Mr. Washington would have done anything different, that he would have not waived his right to be present under the circumstances given his pattern of behavior, and that doing so was, as the court found, was a safety risk to its staff and to Mr. Washington to forcibly bring him to court, into the courtroom to make that waiver.
I have a question about the Court of Appeals. Paragraph 15 says, Washington knowingly and voluntarily abandoned his right under 97104 to be present during the trial proceedings. He did so after being present on the first day of trial. Was he present on the first day of trial?
He was present on the day that trial began.
So why didn't he fall under sub 3?
Because under Dwyer and Miller, the Court of Appeals, I guess, and, you know, backtracking to Justice Ziegler's question, to the extent that paragraph 15 suggests that the trial begins on the first day of trial, or that triggers it, There's two Court of Appeals cases that this Court of Appeals didn't address, Dwyer and Miller, that hold that the beginning of trial is when the jury is sworn.
I know. Was he there when the jury was sworn?
The jury had not been sworn at the
That's my point of asking you that. So he wasn't there when the first day of trial.
Because he was not there when the jury was sworn.
That's
correct.
Right. So I don't know that that's a good sentence. It says he was Washington was did so after being present on the first. He abandoned his right after being present on the first day of trial, initially present at the beginning of the trial proceedings on the day the jury selection began. That's not right. Jury trial begins in Wisconsin, unlike the feds, when the jury is sworn. Then on 16, says the record is clear that Washington knew of his rights. I don't know which right we're talking about. Maybe the right to be present, but maybe not the rights that are involved in the right to be present, and waive them on multiple occasions. And then it goes on to saying he says he's not going to participate. That's paragraph 16. In paragraph 17 and 18, they distinguish it from Dwyer, that Dwyer was a forfeiture rather than a waiver. And there you agree we need waiver here, not forfeiture.
Before trial began yet, yes.
And then I found paragraph 20 interesting of the trial court, of the Court of Appeals, and it's correct that the trial court allowed Washington's counsel to communicate with him, and that the trial court repeatedly inquired whether Washington would like to be present, and that you can't let Washington disrupt the trial. I think all of that is correct. But it seems to me that you could argue that paragraph 20 is good enough without the rest of the opinion. Or you could argue that you don't need 20 if he really waived his right.
Right.
It's irrelevant.
I think once you decide that he has violated the constitutional right, there's not a higher statutory standard for that.
Well,
so.
This is all on the where does he talk about the Constitution?
The circuit court determined that he violated his or that he waived his constitutional right to be present. And that's not a point that he argued
that's
below
right.
He's arguing
this
here.
His whole thing is on the statute.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I just wanted to clarify that too. So it seems to me that the Court of Appeals can be correct that you can't let the defendant disrupt the trial and manipulate and then say, oh, your fault that I'm not there, not my fault. That's paragraph 20.
Right.
But the rest of the opinion says there's waiver, so you don't need both points.
You don't need those points. I believe my understanding of paragraph 20 is that the Court of Appeals is simply endorsing what the circuit court did, how the circuit court handled it, and as a guide for other courts, and
yes.
Just how to handle the situation.
Nothing to do with waiver, but not allowing a defendant to manipulate and destroy a trial.
Correct.
You know, counsel, I'd really like to give you another crack at answering Justice Bradley's question, because I think she and I were both left a little dissatisfied with it, perhaps for different reasons. But she asked you about 10 minutes ago, 12 minutes ago, why it is that had the jury been impaneled and all the other facts remained the same, why it is we wouldn't be concerned about the knowing, intelligent, and voluntary nature of his waiver by conduct. And whereas before the jury is impaneled, sworn, we are having this discussion. Do you have, I guess, just to be blunt, my thought is, why isn't your answer just because the statute says he has to be there when the jury is sworn?
Well, my red light's just gone on. May I
go ahead and
try to answer? it might be that I'm misunderstanding the question. The state's position is basically if a defendant's present at the start of trial, jury's sworn, he absconds, that's enough to impute the knowing, intelligent, that's enough to function as a waiver. Now, if same scenario, he's present and he's there and he actually says, I want a waiver, in theory, I suppose, under subsection 3, he could just leave at that point and the court could do it. But again, we're still, a defendant can waive at any point in trial. It has nothing to do with subsection 3. You can waive before the jury's sworn. You can waive after the jury's sworn. It's just that under the scenario where you just disappear, that'll function as a waiver after trial starts.
Okay.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to start by just pushing back a little bit on the idea that the circuit court did all that it could to communicate with Mr. Washington. Now, certainly there were, I think, 5, as we agreed, instances of communication with Mr. Washington, either by his trial lawyer or by a bailiff. But other than a very brief recitation, there's nothing in the record about what the content of those communications were. It's also quite obvious that Mr. Washington was not in a position of having any trust in his defense lawyer at that point. I think sending the defendant away to jail and saying, hey, let him know he can come back if he wants to, go check and see if he wants to come back, oh no, he doesn't, well, here we go, it communicates that the court is essentially indifferent to whether or not Mr. Washington appears at his trial. I really don't think that is the position that the Wisconsin courts ought to be taking with respect to a person's right to presence.
Yeah. Counsel, I'm interested in the difference between federal law and Wisconsin law with respect to when a trial begins. So for purposes of Rule 43, the federal government says the trial begins on the first day of trial, right? We say it starts when the jury is sworn. Is there any magic to pegging the start of the trial when the jury is sworn rather than the first day of trial?
I don't know if I would call it magic, Justice Kelly, but I do think that there's some reasons.
Okay.
I mean, voir dire is typically in this case, it was one of the 2 days of trial. It's a significant investment of time.
And call it magic.
Pardon?
How many times are you going to get
all right,
a
it's
chance
magic.
To call it
You're right.
magic?
You're right, Justice Gableman. I retract my answer. It's magic. And
very good. So far, so good.
One of the most satisfying responses I've received in 9 years.
But I do think that it's a reasonable place to draw the line. It's consistent with where we draw the line for double jeopardy. It is the place that the Court of Appeals drew the line. This court mentioned it. I won't say that it completely endorsed it at Koopmans, but it certainly mentioned it in a favorable light in the opinion in Koopmans.
So it very well may be that it is a perfectly reasonable place to draw the line. Is it a required place to draw the line?
It's an interpretation of the statute. I can't stand here and say that there's some higher authority for that's where the line has to be drawn.
Is there any functional significance to the difference where we draw the line as opposed to Rule 43?
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by functional significance.
Yes. I mean, does it what difference does that functionally make to the defendant other than the applicability of the statute? But what occurs between the beginning of the day, of the first day of trial, and when the jury is sworn that is so significant that we should say, we really should draw the line at when the jury is sworn?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, or at least two. One I attempted to just describe, which is that voir dire is a significant investment of time. All the time we have trials that are about to start and they just don't because the parties settle. It's not an uncommon thing in our courts for a jury panel to be sitting around and then they just leave. As the Crosby Court pointed out, it puts the defendant on very clear notice that, hey, we're going ahead with this thing. It's also when jeopardy attaches. So one of the things that the Crosby Court talked about was by drawing the line by placing what you avoid having the defendant do is see how the trial's going, and if it's going very badly, and it looks, you know, like a sure conviction, absconding, derailing the trial, and getting a fresh crack at it whenever the defendant decides to show up again. You obviate that problem by saying it's when the jury is sworn.
Well,
and I guess
I
was just
going
to add, I think that some of the questions are sort of driving to a place where I agree with, that what this statute, again, is really about, and maybe it sort of obviates the timing question, the statute is about a defendant that you can't find. It's not about someone who gets thrown out of court or somebody who refuses to come out of their jail cell. And I think in that instance, I think it's an obligation of the court to make sure that that person is knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waiving their right to be present, which I don't think that statute quite meets, although I think it attempts to do more than just a forfeiture.
When I read that as part of the reasoning for waiting until jeopardy attaches, that the last reasoning you gave in regard to kind of a party waiting to see how things are going, and if they're not going satisfactorily, or, you know, get out of Dodge. The same thought occurred to me in regard to the context in which the record that is brought to us that shows Mr. Washington's prior conduct and the success he had in getting delays and getting different lawyers, and then now he's at the day of trial, and he's...
I just want to let you know the light's on.
It is, and his prior custom is I usually get to spit out my question. And
go ahead and spit it out.
She's saying spit it out in short spit. And
Now you just
threw me off track.
I'll take the
now
blame.
I've got to start
okay.
Over. No.
I'll
cut to the heart of it.
Please.
So now we get Mr. Washington, who sees that his kind of MO that he's developed, at least in this case, of asking for different lawyers and delay is not going to work. He's got a judge who's saying, no, we're going forward today, and I'm not going to grant you. And, oh, by the way, I think you've been manipulating the system so far. And then it's at that point he says, I'm out of here. Why shouldn't the law be equally concerned with letting the tail wag the dog of someone in Mr. Washington's position saying, I'm out of here, and just by a happenstance of time prevent the trial from going forward?
I don't think my position is that there was no way to try Mr. Washington that day. My position is that even if it's the court's view that he has been manipulating and attempting to derail the trial or delay the trial, it had an obligation to ensure that any decision on his part to depart was a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you with us today. And we will take a brief break. We will be back out here as soon as the courtroom is cleared of the people who wish to leave and the people arguing the next case are present. Let us know tonight.